Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, August 13th, 2023. And it is the 50th anniversary on the 11th of August of hip-hop. And there are about four or five articles about the history and influence of hip-hop in the Times Magazine this week. And I'll read the featured article, How Hip-Hop Conquered the World. We're celebrating hip-hop's 50th anniversary this week. Wesley Morris traces the art form from its South Bronx origins to all-encompassing triumph. We've gathered here today to raise a glass to hip-hop. It's 50, baby. Half a century of effrontery, dexterity, elasticity, rambunctiousness, ridiculousness, bleakness, spunk, swagger, juice, jiggling wit, of defiant arrogance, devastating humor, consumptive lust, and violent distress of innovation, danger, doubt, and drip. Salud. I'll be honest, though. I knew the magazine covers and concerts and TV specials were coming, but I wasn't feeling it. Seemed too arbitrary a date, or maybe just impossible to ascertain. What I did feel was that hip-hop was so thoroughly infused, has so thoroughly infused the atmosphere of American life, we'll just start with this country, that has pushed so much forward. Who cares that it's pushing 50? The energy giving this form its art, this life its force, wasn't that forged centuries ago with every African hauled onto this land? As far as I could tell, hip-hop was just always. That energy has been with us Black Americans in church, on stages, in studios, on the streets, in outfits and hair and posture and teeth, glinting, grinning, gritting, smirking, snarling, beaming, blinging, simply smiling a miraculous ass smile. So this anniversary couldn't matter, according to me, because, well, isn't it just on a continuum that bends from the African drum to the spiritual to ragtime, jazz, gospel, and the blues, to R&B, folk, rock and roll, funk, disco, new wave, and house? Isn't it always just more soul music, an energy that never dissipates, but simply changes hosts? Well, I was down to bring that dogma to my grave, but somebody made a case, and the case made a fool of me. It was February at the Grammys when, in the middle of the broadcast, almost two dozen rap acts took the stage, one by one, and owned the history they made, the history they were. There was even a historian, Amir Questlove Thompson, who, among sundry other skills and passions, drums for the roots and harbors a knack for the fine print and footnotes of American popular music. For Grammy night, his job entailed boiling down five decades to 15 minutes, and some uncanny artisanship resulted. On the generations came each one submitting no more than a snippet, a tick-tock, yeah, don't stop, if you will. The Roots rapper-in-chief, Black Thought, opened with a fairy tale. 50 years ago, a street princess was born to be an icon, it began. Then appeared a whirl of originators, Grandmaster Flash with Barshan, Mel, Raheem, and Scorpio, who melded into Run DMC and Run DMC into LL Cool J, LL Cool J into DJ Jazzy Jeff, Jazzy Jeff into Salt and Pepper, those two into Rakim, who was followed by Chuck D and Flav. That was simply the first course of three loosely chronological movements. The third closed with the progeny. Lil Baby, then Glorilla, then Lil Uzi Vert. The performances may not have lasted long, But Revelations overtook me anyway. Like how physical this music has always been to make, how bodily Salt and Pepper, Kid and Play, MC Hammer, Missy Elliott, Beyonce, they dance. That's not what I mean. I'm talking about how you can't just stand there and rap. Hands jab, wrists snap, heels stomp, heads nod, bob, swivel, swing. Whatever parts can make action do. Fingers, shoulders, brows. Used to be the move to kind of bow your legs, one hand on each thigh, bend forward and rock. LL would do this so hard, his gold ropes would be punching him in the mouth. Suddenly, something amazed me that just an hour before seemed as elemental as it takes two to make a thing go right. And that's this. The body raps too. Listen, I could go on droolingly about innate hip-hop hotness, about the bodaciousness of physiques, LL, Lil' Kim, Tupac, Trina, 50 Cent, 50 Cent, about Cardi B, about the rocket science profundity and the hook of one of Megan Thee Stallion's hits. Body, adi, 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 adi. But I think what was actually dawning on me that night had less to do with hip-hop's erotic possibilities and more to do with a new, also sexy, frontier. The accrual of carriage, grace, prestige, of stature. Now, this didn't hit me until Queen Latifah took the stage to do a snatch of UNITY. What she wore was black and puffed. Her vest, it sparkled. What astral slope had she downhill to be there? In her early prime, Latifah's limbs and head epitomized this style of embodiment. She nodded with aggression, yet her conical African hats, crowns, refused to capsize. She could still throw down, but in the way only someone in middle age might, with the force of calm, the surety of having fully lived. When I was 13, my question, everybody's question, was what could this music look like at 50? Would it just be the old dude trying to mac at the club? Washed up? Sad? Really could be like going to catch D.D. Bridgewater or Diane Reeves or Cassandra Wilson at Lincoln Center. It could be this. Grand. Presidential. None of this resplendence was irony free. We're talking about the celebration of an art form by an awards show that neglected it. The Grammy's first rap category didn't arrive until 1989, and there had been no plan to present the award during the live broadcast. So some of the nominated acts, including the Fresh Prince, Will Smith, and Salt and Pepper, boycotted. Turbulence has abounded ever since. Hip-hop may have, as Black Thought declared during the anniversary segment's curtain raiser, come to dominate the world, but only twice has it won Album of the Year, and the community has come to feel some type of way. Here then is why I can't exclaim that hip-hop is on a continuum and call it a day. Here's why it's apart from spirituals and jazz, blues, R&B, and rock and roll, while also being a piece. Here's why the passage of these decades matters. Hip-hop, baby of the American musical family, has for 50 years been a contested category. Unsettled because it remains unsettling. Somehow unsung, despite its centrality to multitudes. Tears salted my pizza that night. Because what I thought would be another award show nostalgia spasm was really a proclamation of endurance and a pungent condemnation. Here's music you can hear while dining out at a place where the only black people are you and the dining room soundtrack. There aren't many countries left on this planet that don't have some kind of hip-hop scene a rap patois, some at best oblivious comfort with nigga this and that, Yet there's often a chip on some rapper's shoulder, on some rap fans, because it's quite something half a century in to carry with you the suspicion that the thing you made might be valued more than the people you are. This is a continuum concern, of course. Every phase of Black artistic achievement treks through that cognitive dissonance zone. The Negro spiritual is the other major American music whose existence floodlights a crime. But spirituals sought deliverance from this country's original sin. Hip-hop doesn't expect salvation. An alternate reality drives its craftspeople. Maybe nobody wants us to succeed, so we'll deliver ourselves. Let's build an empire from that. I'm just younger enough than hip-hop to have taken the empire for granted all these decades, and just old enough to ask some urgent questions. What's the point of this art form anyway? Why did we need it? Why did we need it so bad that it spread from the Bronx to everywhere else? Would there even be hip-hop had events in this country gone differently, gone farther, in Black Americans' favor? Then I suppose I have to ask, which events? And how many would have had to go just right and stay right in order to complete Black Americans' trajectory toward actual freedom, to head off the full force of hip-hop's coming this vibrantly to life? Some back-of-the-napkin ruminating tells me that hip-hop was inevitable because this country has never been consistently sure about how to treat us. The mere fact of hip-hop denounces that inconsistency. Maybe shouldn't exist, but here it is, in everything. Indicting. This 50th anniversary dates to the night in the Bronx in August 1973 that Kool Herc stood over a set of turntables and combined two records to form one continuous break beat. Doesn't sound too seismic when you put it that way. But this was it, the Big Bang, a mythical event. And when you do put it that way, these 50 years really do have to stand on their own. The earliest blues artists were enslaved. Depending on when you think jazz was born, we're talking about both history and mythology here. Its originators had parents who were enslaved. The inventors of rock and roll hailed from parts central and south. But hip-hop happens right about when the Great Migration winds down. Its beginnings are overwhelmingly northern and completely urban. A DJ would play records and crews would dance. The early MCs, they were personalities who sometimes talked over the music. Rhyming and beat-making machinery, those came later. Inertia, idleness, conditions hip-hop was born trying to solve. How to keep b-boys and b-girls breaking all night. DJs invented the cure. Hip-hop identified a culture that already existed but made kids, adolescents, and barely adults make sense to themselves. The new Negroes, fresh, then dope, then fly, then fire, then Rizzy. They were also, to invoke a timeless community outreach, daily news euphemism, at risk, condemned. This music had penury, denial, and neglect in common with its forebears, and was developed down in a particularly hopeless ravine amid the national abandonment of the post-civil rights movement after the feel-good blackness of Motown was deemed passé. When afros and dashikis were part of the urban uniform, and even Sidney Poitier was directing blaxploitation movies. White suburbanites rallied to stop Richard Nixon from stopping housing discrimination. Not that ending it was his idea. Ronald Reagan slashed the housing and urban development budget by about 70%. Elevator stayed broken. Trash piled up. Drugs stormed in, and with them even harsher law enforcement. Oh, guess what else turns 50 this year? The DEA. You might expect the blues to take hold, or at least an ambivalence. Nope. An exuberant, insistent, impossible resolve to find early hip-hop, the jive part of the blues, the imaginative toughness, the tautology thriving. That's the breaks. That's the breaks. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like that, and that's the way it is. Huh. The music was street-bound, and the people performing it could be as hard as concrete and blacktop, as smooth as menthol smoke, in leather and velour and denims, in shell tops, Jordans, and eventually Tim's, in Coogies and tracksuits with Kangols, Kazals, stopwatches, and kitchen clock garlands, gold ropes you could use to moor a yacht, and gold earrings fit for announcing yourself at a castle door. They were battle-tested, arriving as victors, always slaying, never slain. Canniness and certitude were more important than luck. Defense outfitted as offense. Preemptive style. LL Cool J's first appearance on the Billboard Hot 100 was for the scratchy, boom-bapping wall crawler he called I'm Bad, and the interludes of a police manhunt between the verses tell me he knew that. Not even a quarter century before, he might have been nightsticked, at best, for thinking so highly of himself. The thrill of the music, the lifestyle, that life force, has been its array of swaggers, MC Lights, sniping allergy to fools, Big Daddy Kane's lounging backpats, his own, Rakim's cashmere self-portraiture, Salt and Pepa's tag team assertiveness, the audacity of both bragginess and hip-huggery, the collage work rightly deemed mix mastery. Eyebrows might arch at any art form as reliant upon the performance of cockiness, but when vertiginous pride emanates from black egos, eyes tend to burn in their sockets. It's not as if black artistic expression has ever relied on doubt. Consider all that it took for Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, Dinah Washington, Billie Holiday, or for Mahalia Jackson, Nat King Cole, Sammy Davis Jr., or Miles Davis, for the Supremes and the Temptations to embody, then exude excellence during an era in which that sort of confidence was all but illegal in certain counties, when you were likely to have had a parent who fled those places. It's just that a certain decorum was expected. Take Motown. Berry Gordy put his artists through a rigorous etiquette program to make them palatable to the crowds of Jim Crow-tolerant white people who would be seeing them in concert or from their living rooms. I've wondered what kind of rappers a charm school might produce. I've also thought about what just a little charmlessness might have done for, or to, the Motown sound. Charm afforded Motown its bounteous luxury. But by the late 70s and early 80s, black decorum had reached its political limit. Gordy's big new star was the magnetically louche Rick James, a hip-hop progenitor. The early rappers weren't arguing for integration. They cultivated iconography all their own. Hairstyles, accessories, attitudes, these celebratory exponents of apartness, of apartheid in America. The art form's greatest innovation was its mass production of unfettered, unselfconscious self-esteem, of retributive refulgence. Boy, could you feel that? Friends and classmates took on such an unsinkable boldness that I can't imagine them without this music and its style. But around the country, all kinds of people were encouraged by Hollywood and the news to be scared of black youth, as they were called. Some of those people took out full-page ads wishing them the death penalty. Some chased them from neighborhoods and mistook them for piñatas. Our parents, though, weren't afraid of the kids and the rappers those kids adored, not necessarily. The moms and dads and grandparents, the aunts, uncles, and older cousins understood the old life-or-death stakes. They knew that hip-hop had unleashed a new confrontational energy. They were afraid for them. I've thought sincerely about whether hip-hop's boastfulness was a wonder drug for black psyches in search of street-level hope. These rappers emerged from the same poverty a lot of us knew, but they turned that doubt into bright-sided art. So many black children were scolded and mocked for dreaming of careers in basketball and rap. The odds were worse than low. We're talking about young people, though. They dream. Somebody really is always making it in hip-hop. Why not one of them? I grew up watching all the practicing and rehearsing and studying, the rigor. The dream was big. They knew they could maybe be paid to fly, paid to flow. They could turn on a radio or press play on a mixtape and hear the flight. For 50 years, the essential writing, fables, comedies, diaries, adventure, memoir, porn about young black life in this country has been happening in hip-hop. Songs about feelings, fantasies, dilemmas, confessions, fantasias. What else is Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die and its grueling, knowing, melodic recreation of moral decay and sexual congress other than a triumph of literature? It is but one title on a shelf buckling with scores of comparable powerhouses. That's one masterpiece. Set in New York City. What eventually brews in Houston and Atlanta, Miami, New Orleans and Memphis and Virginia and California deepens hip-hop, takes it into freaky, funky, bouncy, hilarious, mischievously brewed realms, dark, dreamy, unstable landscapes. Frailty, paranoia, trippiness, Afrocentrism, and minimalism emerge. It's music mining the past, but potently about the present, often about itself. Hip-hop kids didn't know a national struggle for civil rights as more than lore or part of a lesson plan. They'd experienced personal strife, the struggle for food, shelter, safety, stability, jobs, and respect. How many of these artists came of age in or adjacent to public housing and the criminal justice system? Plight was in the art. Hip-hop represents a break with the past because it exploded out of something that broke this country's promise to its black citizens. And unlike aspects of jazz and Motown, this new music wouldn't be arguing for its resplendence, worthiness, and incomparable ingenuity. Solves, appeasement, subtlety, civility, love, those evidently didn't work because here we are. Bring the noise. Its practitioners may have attended church, but there's little church in this music, especially during its first waves, just communal, jubilation, and the streets. La-dee-da-dee, we like to party. Alongside, I never prayed to God, I prayed to Gotti. Hip-hop arose from want. It thrived in gain. The average love song culminates in consumption, brandishing what has been consumed. Capitalism has been trying to turn its back on black America and to break black America's back. Hip-hop is Julia Roberts after being written off in Pretty Woman by that snooty sales lady. Big mistake. Big. Huge. The drug dealers and gangbangers weren't my cup of tea. I more naturally gravitated to the nerds, Bohemians, and Space Cadets, the corners of the music that got called conscious rap. But I never bought that designation. You don't enumerate the risks and luxuriate in the spoils of, say, the drug business unconsciously. How could you lavish such attention on production and rhythm? How could you realize such vision with half a mind? Choices are being made, the choice to be frank, blunt, hyperbolic, wishful, catchy. Whatever pathologies in the art form mirrors whatever pathology exists in the environment, in hip-hops, in the nations. Cash rules everything around me. C-R-E-A-M functions as much as an excuse as it does as a rationale. Luxury has become a source of irony. I mean, the fact of Gucci Mane alone, and a kind of getting even. What's it Bay said? Best revenge is your paper. Before that reunion at the Grammys, I knew all the places the life force had gone and all it had come to mean. But after, I got to thinking about its stupendous range. Take the rap voice, for instance. It's an instrument with timbres and pitches that expand at least my understanding of what else it means to sing. And if it's Old Dirty Bastard, Eminem, Nicki Minaj, and Kendrick Lamar, we're talking about singing in the rain, a monsoon. There's almost nowhere hip-hop hasn't been. The White House, the Pulitzers, the Oscars, the sitcom, the Louvre, Syllabi, country radio, Fashion Week, Sesame Street. It uses some of everything, and everything uses some of it. But its longevity and ubiquity amount to more than what's stamped in its passport. Even when its practitioners aren't black, maybe especially when they're white, hip-hop incriminates the country that drove its people to dream it up in the first place. For it contains the stubborn truth of how America has felt about certain Americans. Hip-hop is what this country gets. It still possesses incantatory powers, but it also continues to acquire a tremendous capacity for melancholy, for a blues of sorts. The same group who fretted about C-R-E-A-M also chanted in harmony that you can't party your life away, drink your life away, smoke your life away, expletive your life away, dream your life away, scheme your life away, because your seeds grow up the same way. That was 26 years ago. In the BLM era, the seeds sound addled. The early boom bap and the disco backbeats that exploded into a galaxy of sounds has, in its current incarnation, returned to a new, samey orthodoxy of beats that, for not much longer than 2 minutes, stutter, drag, and drone. A little weed used to be all a rapper needed to get by. Now it's zany. It's not just nerves that seek settling anymore. It's entire psyches. The canon makes room for breakdowns. Lauryn Hill's, Kendrick Lamar's, Kanye West's, happiness and abandon are now hard to come by, that old sauce. The rappers seem to know this. They're rhyming with a lot fewer words for the moment. The sound of some of this music doubles as another environmental mirror. Somebody thought to call it trap. Maybe another reason that the Grammy anniversary segment got to me was that it worked in defiance of the current gravity. It felt stress-free and full of exhalation, but as crucial, also put inhalation on poignant display. As a practical matter, this wasn't news. We karaoke people have our personal Everest, paid in full, and Mama Said Knock You Out are mine. Very different songs and divergent styles. One is Silk, the other is Steroids. To pull either off, you have to know how to breathe. This is true enough for singing, but rapping requires the kind of respiration that a swimmer depends on. Mechanical but rhythmic. to excel at either, it helps to know your way around a freestyle. Rappers have to time when in the stroke to snatch some air, snatch wrong and choke. You have to be precise while still being you. Some rappers like Busta Rhymes rarely get caught taking a breath. A karaoke rapper will tell you, it's not for the weak. I know someone who can perform the crossroads as though Bone Thugs and Harmony were his government name. But by the time he's done, he practically needs CPR. At the Grammys, as Busta stood there and 50-meter backstroked his way through Look at Me Now, no one seemed to quite believe that he could still rap that fast, that breathlessly. It wasn't him at his most pinpoint. His stroke made a lot of splash. But when he finished, nobody called the paramedics either. They cheered the dexterity, obviously, but also that he still had it, that everybody over the age of, 28, still had it, could still do the one thing we've heard so many of us in states of distress plead for. Breathe. Nobody thought it would last this long. Maybe that's some deeply ingrained self-doubt talking. Not everything lasts, and not everybody made it. Reason enough to pause and pay tribute to say, hip-hop hooray. What they've made, however, has lasted. That's what started my waterworks. Everybody was still breathing. Yeah, many of them are still alive and all. But also, they're still able to make breath, deep, exhilarating breath. The author of the article, Wesley Morris, is a critic at large and the co-host with Jenna Wortham of the cultural podcast Still Processing. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for criticism, including in 2021 for a set of essays that explore the intersection of race and pop culture. More about Wesley Morris. Now I'll read the talk section of the magazine. The interview, as usual, is David Marchese. The world's happiest man shares his 3 rules for life. There's a picture of the world's happiest man, Matthew Ricard. Matthew Ricard is an ordained Buddhist monk and an internationally best-selling author of books about altruism, animal rights, happiness, and wisdom. His humanitarian efforts led to his homeland's awarding him the French National Order of Merit. Ricard's primary residence is a Nepalese monastery. He was the Dalai Lama's French interpreter and holds a PhD in cellular genetics. In the early 2000s, researchers at the University of Wisconsin found that Ricard's brain produced gamma waves, which have been linked to learning, attention, and memory at such pronounced levels that the media named him the world's happiest man. He was also late for our Zoom, and it was driving me nuts. Didn't he get my confirmation email? Why hadn't he emailed to say he was running late? I had deadlines, tight deadlines. My carefully planned schedule was being shot to hell. Alas, everything turned out fine, as it was always going to. Clearly, I had much to learn about taming the mind. You should not get quickly discouraged, said Ricard, whose memoir, Notebooks of a Wandering Monk, is forthcoming. You cannot master playing the piano now. These skills take time. David asks, okay, so I've been meditating twice a day for probably 15 years, and I feel as if it has improved my ability to control my thoughts and emotions instead of letting them control me. But still, sometimes I'll walk by a mirror and have an extreme flash of self-loathing, or I'll get all agitated over something stupid like finding a parking spot. Will that stuff ever go away? Well, they can, absolutely. You know, once I was on the India Today conclave, they said, can you give us the three secrets of happiness? I said, first, there's no secret. Second, there's not just 3 points. Third, it takes a whole life, but it's the most worthy thing you can do. I'm happy to feel I am on the right track. I cannot imagine feeling hate or wanting someone to suffer. And David says, it's not the best thing to say, but I can easily imagine wanting certain people to suffer. How are we supposed to deal gracefully with our polar opposites in a world that feels increasingly about polarities? I mean, the Dalai Lama could talk to Vladimir Putin all he wants, but Putin's not going to say, your compassion has changed me. Once a long time ago, someone said to me, this is Ricard talking, once a long time ago, someone said to me, who's the